Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonia Rappaport.
Sonia, we have concluded the Spider-Man years. We have also concluded the X-Men years like a billion lifetimes ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now we are entering a bold new frontier of the unknown. And to kick that off, we are traveling back in time to the incredible, unforgettable year of 2005 to talk about the Fantastic Four movie.
All right, we live to podcast another day.
Yeah, this will be the first in potentially a series of infinite mystery podcast episodes. If you want a clue as to what we're going to be talking about from week to week, I'd recommend joining the X-Men Task Podcast Facebook group. Just search out X-Men Task Podcast on Facebook. You could also follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson and rate and review us 5 stars on the iTunes reviewing thing. But yeah, the Fantastic Four, this is a movie that I don't think you've seen properly ever. Am I correct?
Yeah, I saw it on an airplane once, but I fell asleep. I didn't see most of it.
Okay, so you've mostly never seen it.
Uh-huh.
Now you've given it a fair crack. Unlike Spider-Man 3, we did not watch this movie at 1.5 speed.
I know. I realized it as we were watching and wondered if we were making a mistake.
I don't think we did. I think it was nice to just take the film in as normal people do and just absorb it and and see how it fits into our brains in the year 2020 in a much different world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some surprising results that we concluded that you might conclude yourselves if you give it a go in 2020. But we'll get to all that. Let's talk about the movie. It was directed by Tim Story. The only thing I know about Tim Story is that I remembered his name. I snuck into the only time I ever snuck into a movie theater one night. I was in college. It was the summertime. And me and my buddy, we snuck into movies. Nobody cared. And the two movies we saw were the sequel to Ocean's 11. Oh, Ocean's 12. And then we snuck into The Italian Job, which I guess was a remake. And I remember seeing Tim Story's name as the director of that thoroughly below-average movie. And what do you know? 20th Century Fox thought he'd be the perfect man to helm the Fantastic Four movie.
Well, after a succession of a whole bunch of other directors that they'd been working with since the early 90s or even late 80s, I think.
Right. So I'll briefly go over the history of this film. It's kind of notorious. In the early 80s, Stan Lee moved to Hollywood, and his mission for Marvel was to try to sell Hollywood on Marvel properties for movies. And I remember, I've talked about in the podcast before, he was really obsessed with selling Ant-Man. That was he really thought that would make for a great movie. He did sell the movie rights for Fantastic Four to some German company, Constantin Films, for, they don't know exactly for how much, but it wasn't a lot of money. It was like $250,000. And that would inaugurate a history of Marvel selling low on their most valuable properties in crappy Hollywood deals. But this Constantin Films didn't have the means or the ability to make a proper Fantastic Four movie. But in order for them to retain the rights, they hired Roger Corman to make what's known as an ashcan copy of the film. So we've talked about this Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie before, and I think most of you know the story that, Constantin Films basically made this thing just to hold onto the said rights of Fantastic Four, and it was a film that was never supposed to be released.
I think it was like a $1 million budget.
Yeah, they spent $1 million on it. The actors in the film thought they were making, a true Fantastic Four movie. They had no idea this movie would just be shit-canned. But it did leak out eventually. I think I saw it in college. It was already on the internet. I think you might even be able to watch the whole thing on YouTube right now. It's available. Maybe we'll talk about that movie one day. It is kind of fun in a goofy, earnest way, but it is also bad. So that allowed Constantin's film to hold on to the rights, and then they eventually made a deal with 20th Century Fox. And after a bunch of attempts to get it going, they finally did. In 2004-2005, I guess spurred on by the success of X-Men and Spider-Man, showing that Marvel properties were hot.
But there was a problem in the production because the animated film or Pixar film The Incredibles came out in 2004, and the plot points were so similar that they had to make a whole bunch of script and character changes to the Fantastic Four film so that they weren't just copying The Incredibles.
I mean, and the irony is that The Incredibles is almost a direct ripoff of the Fantastic Four in the yeah. first place. So, right, that's kind of strange. That The Incredibles sort of, like, got to and conquered the ground of the Fantastic Four, which has been around since the early 60s.
Yeah. That's a cute movie, if you haven't seen it.
I've never seen it. I don't plan to.
You don't like Pixar films, so really. That's fine. But anyone out there who has no aversion to Pixar films and you haven't seen it, it's worth a watch. It's cute.
I feel like I was just at the cusp of being too old to ever care about any Pixar movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess Toy Story came out in 95 and I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably should have been in the right, you know, era to enjoy that movie, but I didn't for whatever reason. And I don't know.
I mean, I wasn't a kid when The Incredibles came out, obviously.
Yeah.
I worked with kids. I was a teacher of kids that really liked the movie. So I guess, I don't know if I would watch it if I was like just an adult with no connection.
I hear you. So this is one of those movies that you had to show to kids
it was like when I was like teaching at this school and there was always like 20 minutes to a half hour after lunch where everyone would just kind of like... We'd have the kids just kind of like sit down and chill out and we'd put on a movie. And like by popular demand, like they always wanted to watch The Incredibles. I mean, we were showing it in like 20 to 30 minute chunks, but I must have seen this movie like hundreds of times
oh my God.
In total. I don't know.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the good old Fantastic Four. Like we said, directed by Tim Story. He's kind of just like a cheap Hollywood gun for hire type director. I don't think he's done anything too of note. I know he did that movie The Italian Job, which I snuck in to see in the movies with my friend at some point when we were in college, and I remember that being thoroughly mediocre, too bad. So he's not like the most like splashiest name to be hired to direct a movie, but he does bring something to this film.
Mm-hmm.
He brings a somewhat like interesting take on everything. And I think he almost succeeds, by the way, which we're going to have a big discussion about, like, what the true value of this film is and how it holds up and everything. But before we do all that, let's get into the cast. So the guy who plays Reed Richards, do you know how to pronounce his name? And if so, I think you're one of the few people on Earth that would.
This is a guess, but I think it's Ian Gruffudd.
Right.
Right? It's spelled I-O-A-N, but I think it's pronounced Ian.
It's very tough to read. I'd have to... I mean, I know he's a British actor, or maybe he's, you know, Scottish or Irish. I'm not quite sure. But the point is, it is a weird spelling of Ian. Let's just call him Ian Gruffudd, right?
Like, why? I think. If someone has better information, let us know. But
right. Okay, so he's in there. He's Mr. Fantastic. You know, kind of a... I think... Let's break them down personally. I think
he's
miscast.
Sort of slight for a Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what do you mean by that, actually?
Like, physically, I feel like Mr. Fantastic is a little bit more of, like, a square-shouldered, like...
A little taller, perhaps.
Just a bigger person, a bigger presence.
He's muscular. He looks good in the outfit, but you're right. I think he is not quite what I would picture in my head. I think getting a British man was not a good choice. I think you would have wanted to find some kind of, like...
I mean, he does the American accent. Like, you can't tell that he's British unless you knew.
He sounds kind of whiny, though. I think you would want someone with a deeper, more authoritative voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I always pictured his voice when I read him in the comics. He's just very stern and, like, he knows everything. He's a know-it-all.
Mm-hmm.
And but he's got... You know, he smokes a pipe and just kind of doesn't want to hear any riff-raff from anybody.
I'll be honest,
I would have gone for like someone from the Mad Men universe of actors, that would have reminded me of the 1960s, some kind of weird old throwback face.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, I'm reminded of, I mean, not saying this would have been a good guy because he probably would have been too slight too, but remember in Mad Men, the guy that was Duck Phillips?
Uh-huh.
He was brought in and I think season two at some point, or maybe even season one.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the guy that I think is where you want to go for a Mr. Fantastic's. Like, middle-aged, but still, like, has some vitality to him.
Hmm.
Anyway, this guy just, like, doesn't quite work for me. And none of it makes sense with the next casting, Jessica Alba, as the Invisible Woman, Sue Storm.
Yeah.
Because, like, were they supposed to be in college at the same time?
But she's, like, a lot younger than him,
I think. She was 24 when this was filmed, and I'm sure Ian Gruffudd was older. Which, I don't know. I don't know how much older, but...
Her casting also doesn't super make sense. They make her wear blue contact lenses.
Right. I mean, you can tell
they're fake. You can always tell when contact lenses are fake.
I remember reading something about how they whitewashed her for this film.
They dyed her hair blonde.
Yeah, I don't really know the full controversy about Jessica Alba, but that's besides the point. I think she's terribly miscast in this role.
I think in real life she's Cuban, maybe? Half Cuban?
Okay. But I would just say that, like, I don't know where, like, whose fault it is with the disaster that is Jessica Alba's performance in this film. I think it probably is mostly the script. They literally give the character, like, nothing to do or say but sort of just bat her eyes and whine about her relationship with Reed Richards, right?
Yeah. I mean, she rarely passes the Bechdel test, I would say.
I don't think she does. I don't really even think she speaks to another woman in the entire film.
Yeah, that's true.
And anytime she's speaking to a man, it's usually about her relationship. It's just so poorly written. Weirdly in line with the original Sue Storm character from the early 60s, where it was written incredibly misogynistically, where she was essentially just Reed's girlfriend who would put on an apron at times to dust up the Baxter building. Mm-hmm. She was like a maid. Or, like, the mom of the group, and it was stupid. And, you know, eventually over the years, they fleshed out her character and made her much more powerful and interesting and less of, like, a, you know, a wilting butterfly. I don't even know if that's the right word there, but... anyway, this is, like, just... I can't stress enough how much Jessica Alba...
Oh, I'm sorry. I just looked it up on Wikipedia because it was bothering me. She's not Cuban. Her father is Mexican-American.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah, the whole controversy with the blonde hair, blue eyes is, like, it's weird.
It is weird. And she, you know, just she's one of the things that's, like, not great about the film. But we'll get into all that. And then you've got the legendary Chris Evans as Johnny Storm, which his performance in this film is so complete for what he was going for that it I think for a lot of people, myself included, when they decided that he was going to be Captain America, it took a lot of people a long time to even imagine what that would be like, given what he gave us as Johnny Storm here.
Yeah, I think he was well cast as Johnny Storm.
I think, like, he played the part in the script as completely as possible.
Yeah,
he is, like, fully committed to playing a mid-2000s uber douche who is, like, totally narcissistic and just a stupid party animal man, but he's committed to the character, so I think his acting is, like, weirdly good in this movie. It's just that it's unfortunate.
Especially in contrast with Captain America, you know?
Yes.
Like, he does give two distinct performances for those two characters.
Yes.
It is weird that he's recast in the Marvel Universe, and then you have to imagine the same...
He wouldn't be the first one, but... Yeah,
right. Of all the actors out there, it's just odd that they made choices like that to, like... let go of the Fantastic Four. And
I know.
Put him in,
it's,
you know,
strange that they're like, okay, like, we saw the Fantastic Four movies where he is, like, just he, like, very memorable as this completely unlikable character, but we're going to give him another shot as Captain America, one of the linchpins of our entire cinematic universe.
It's just like they never imagined that the whole Marvel universe would become the MCU and that all of it could potentially one day be linked up and that they would have these weird, like, anomalies of one person who's playing two people.
Well,
it's like they couldn't see that far into the future the MCU.
That's part of it. But also, I mean, these Fantastic Four movies are basically non-canon now.
Right.
They're going to reboot them for a third time, and these movies will have never existed.
Yeah, fair.
So, but I just think the weirder aspect is that they would give Chris Evans another chance in a radically different role. But I don't know. He must have tested extremely positively, even in these movies. And I wouldn't be surprised, too, because, like I said, I think he's earnestly doing the job as good as possible. But I was going to say, it's unfortunate that the character is just... has these hallmarks of early mid-2000s douchebaggery that I think are, like, quite accurate for the time. Like, a sort of 2005 was, like, a cultural desert in American history. I mean, we still might be in that desert to a certain extent, but really back then... Just
the background music says it all. I mean, like, the soundtrack of the movie is basically, like, a Sum 41 or some kind, what do you call that kind of music even?
Just like nu metal, nu punk, with spelled N-U.
Yeah. That's also like a hallmark of that time.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, just like some of the worst culture. I remember being in 2005, I would have, I was in college, and just, it was just a shitty time to be a young man culturally. You know, I was like so anti the culture at the time. I was, everything with me was retro. I was just like the Beatles, Bob Dylan, just any like sort of like 1960s aesthetic, like anything to like not be living in the time we lived in then, when everything was ugly to me, the fashion, the music.
Well, I mean, now it's 15 years later. Do you still feel like that about that era of?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And this the nostalgia I feel for it is just like, there is just a stupid innocence to the time, and
right. I mean, like, if that's your thing, if that's like a style that you appreciate or that you feel nostalgic for, you know, no judgments, to each their own.
I mean, I'll judge you.
All right.
If you're pining for 2005, I think you need to like look to some other decades for some inspiration. I don't know. It was a weird time in America. It was post 9/11. The attitude of America shifted in a big way after 9/11, and it just like infiltrated the culture and just like everything, like masculinity, it all like changed top to bottom, and it just wasn't good in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it's just I was too close to it at the time, and so I'm just overly sensitive to like the styles and the music and the whole thing. But and I think, like, most people will probably agree with me.
Yeah, no. It just makes me think of, like, frosted tips and tribal tattoos.
Yeah, awful boy bands and just, like, the worst everything. I mean, and this movie, unfortunately, has to be lumped into that. Although, I can still, like, find a way to appreciate this movie, and we'll get into that, too, which I think is interesting, about the things we liked about this film. But let's move on with the cast. The great Michael Chiklis as The Thing, Ben Grimm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you gotta, like, he's part of the movie that works for me.
Yeah.
He wanted the part. I guess he was a fan of the comics. He also fought hard to be in a prosthetic suit, not to be done over with CGI.
Mm-hmm. Which I appreciate that.
I appreciate that, too. I think the suit, although it is like a stupid hunk of rubber he's wearing, I think it works. I mean, I would prefer a more Muppety suit than I would a CGI recreation that looks like shit.
Right.
You know, I like that he's there in the scenes acting. There's like a totally weird thing he's doing when he's a human and then when he's the thing that we'll get into as well that makes no sense. You know, he's a part of the movie that works. Julian McMahon as Dr. Doom. I don't know much about this actor. I know he was in that show Nip Tuck. Mm-hmm. That's about it.
Yeah.
I feel like, for what they're going for in this movie, where they're trying to update it and make it modern and make it make sense in a modern context, I think he, like, mostly succeeds. But the problem is not his. It's just that in any of these movies that have featured Dr. Doom, he's never been done correctly. Marvel, when they resurrect Dr. Doom at some point, which they certainly will, they just have to, like, really dive deep into the Latveria Eastern European aspect of the character and just own it.
Yeah, they reference Latveria a couple of times throughout the movie, but they don't really give him anything to work with. He's just like the bad guy skulking in the shadows all the time.
And he's an American dude. He don't have any like sense that he's some dictator living in a castle in medieval Europe somewhere.
Yeah.
Which I know is a ridiculous premise, but there has to be a way to make that work because the Dr. Doom character is really cool, both visually and, like, his backstory.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's just weird.
I mean, I was going to say before, honestly, I don't feel like I'm really one to be able to criticize too harshly any of the characterizations because I was never a devout Fantastic Four fan.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my knowledge of them comes from their cameos in, like, the animated series.
And me just blabbing on about them to you at various times.
Yeah. Your theories about them.
Right, and me just, like, insisting to you, like, no, it's a good comic book. These are good characters.
Right, but I just never could get past the Sue Storm thing, so I never got into them for real.
Right,
but,
right, because you didn't like that she was Invisible Girl.
Just as a Marvel fan, I'm here to throw in my two cents, but also,
I mean, she's one of the, like we've talked about in other podcasts, she is one of the, like, worst female superheroes.
Yes, I mean
the way she started.
We'll get into it, but yeah. Also we get one more like sort of lead role from Kerry Washington, who is an incredible actress. In this movie, we don't even get her name.
She's like, Alicia. I think we get Alicia. Oh, yeah, I forget Alicia, her last name in the comments. Right. Like Alicia Masters, maybe.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, she's really more of a side character, and
she's Ben Grimm's girlfriend. She's blind, so it's also the idea that only a blind woman could love him is
yeah.
Whatever. It's fine. It's from the comics. It's okay. She has a very minimal part, but it's interesting to see Kerry Washington before she was mega famous.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the cast. This movie cost $100 million, made $333 million at the box office, which I guess was good enough to warrant a sequel, which it got with Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. We'll talk about that at some point. But, yeah, I mean, I don't even remember this movie coming out, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I was obviously always a huge superhero fan. I mean, I must have been aware of it. I definitely didn't go to see it in the movie theater.
I didn't either, no.
I mean, I don't know what I was thinking. Maybe I was just poor being in college and didn't have like money to spend on the movies all the time. Or maybe I just knew that it sucked and I was like, this would be a waste of my time. So I pirated it probably.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I enjoyed it initially. At the time, my earliest memories, I remember not liking it. I remember being let down by it. I probably did think it had potential, though, to be better. And when I heard that there was going to be a sequel... with the Silver Surfer, I was excited. I was like, okay, maybe they've set up the story. Now they're just going to make a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not. I've come to sort of like a little bit. I was going to say appreciate, but I don't appreciate it. but the sequel, I definitely don't think I'm going to, when we rewatch it, I don't think I'm going to like, and I definitely do not appreciate it. That one the sequel, actively bothers me.
That might be a 1.5 speed one.
That might be, I don't know, we'll see about that. I do want to give that one a fair shake again, too, because okay. I was surprised about what I took from here.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, so we'll get into everything. Let's just start from the beginning.
All right. So we open up with Reed and Ben going to visit Victor Von Doom. He's like a big, successful businessman with lots of money.
It's interesting because now if they were going to do this plot, he would be a Steve Jobs type.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of before that era in a way where they would even recognize that like tech moguls.
Right.
He's almost like a proto Elon Musk, mm-hmm. this version of Victor Von Doom. He's the chairperson and founder of, you know, Von Doom Enterprises or whatever it's called. And he's, I don't know, like we said, he's like an Americanized Dr. Doom. Doesn't quite make sense. There's something shady about him. And Ben Grimm uses a very strange combination of words by describing his company as fast food strip mall science.
Yeah, I guess he just means that he's in like science or tech or something, but there's little depth to it.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, because Victor Von Doom owns an international space station, a private one that can dock, you know, shuttlecraft and has artificial gravity. It's like his science is actually pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why Ben Grimm would think it's fast food strip mall science.
Or maybe just because it's very like geared towards investment and making money and not just science for the sake of science or for helping people.
Right. Anyway, Reed is desperate for money, we learn, and he's got an idea because a cosmic storm is heading towards Earth, and he has a theory that an initial cosmic storm, you know, billions of years ago came towards Earth, and that led to the evolution of life on our planet, which I think that's a really cool updating of the story. I think in the initial story, the initial story of the Fantastic Four is that Reed Richards is this, like hopped up patriotic scientist who wants to steal a rocket from NASA because he wants to beat the Reds into getting into space. Like that's literally his quote from the comics.
Need to steal a rocket to do that? NASA is on that mission.
I don't know. So it's just completely stupid. Like him and his friends, you know, Johnny, Ben, and Sue, they sneak into a NASA base or some kind of U.S. military base. I don't even know if NASA existed in 1961. It might have. And they steal a rocket. And then they encounter a cosmic storm, which transforms them all into the Fantastic Four. And here, I think it was cool that they're saying, like, no, like, he wants to study a cosmic storm that's coming because he has a theory about it causing life on Earth. And then he thinks that, like, by studying the storm, he'll be able to like use the research to cure diseases and extend human life as we know it.
Right. He's going to study what it does to DNA.
Right. So I was like,
he made his little like 3D like slideshow presentation or whatever for Victor Von Doom.
That's a big trope in these sci-fi movies. They have like inexplicable hologram technology that's interactive and takes up a whole room, that like something that's never like quite existed in real life.
It's like on pace exactly with the words he's saying. He says like electrical storm and it shows the storm, and then he says DNA and it shows a strand of DNA, and I just was imagining him sitting down like creating his PowerPoint.
Yeah, it's like a hell of a PowerPoint. Very amazing looking. Victor Von Doom, one of his character traits in this movie is that he has no patience. He cuts Reed off as Reed's getting earnest about like the ability to like use this as a benefit for mankind, and he's like, all right, I'll go into business with you. And but he's more like concerned, instead of with like the science of this, he wants to make money, like you said.
But and there's also like a revenge sort of thing, right, happening. We find out that the two of them went to MIT together, and
not Empire State University, which I think is more
right. And Reed was always like the smarter one, like top of the class, always like beating Victor.
Victor was number two.
And now Victor feels like he finally won at life because he has this successful business, and he's the one that Reed is coming to like ask for a handout, essentially.
Right. And I like all this setup because like Victor tosses a magazine showing that Reed Richards is bankrupt. So I like that Reed Richards is sort of a world famous scientist, which he would be because he's the smartest man on Earth. And, you know, and Victor is, like, holding it over his head to make Reed agree to a very shitty deal as far as, like, splitting the potential profits of this research.
Right.
But, you know, as we learn, Reed's not really in it for the money. He's in it for the science.
The other thing that we see here is that it's Sue Storm is working for Victor's company. And this is the first time that she's referred to outright as an object in the movie.
Ben, really? What were the words?
Yeah, Ben, like, leans over to Reed, and he's like, oh, that's another thing that Victor got that you didn't, or something.
Yeah, it's pretty weak.
And not the last time that she's referred to as a thing.
So she should have been called the thing.
Yeah, that would have been really appropriate.
Right. That sounds. I feel dirty even making that joke. That sounds weird. But go on.
No, that was the extent of my outrage.
Right, okay, yeah. So, anyway, Victor's like, okay, this is going to be $1 billion deal. You'll get 25%, and he alludes to the fact, like, oh, you'll be able to keep the lights running at the Baxter Building. Which, again, I think that's cool that, like, the Baxter Building, like, Reed owns the building, or at least the top 10 floors of it, or whatever.
Right, so what's up with Reed's financial situation? He's, like, can't even form the words because it makes a little sense. At first, he's portrayed as having no money and he has to go around asking for handouts for his like science project.
Or he goes to NASA first, apparently. NASA rejects him.
Right. But then, how is he rich enough that he owns the Baxter Building and has his whole like setup that we're going to see? They're taking up several floors of this building, the penthouse.
I think it's pretty clear that
he made his money in science, or what?
He's the world's smartest man. He must have gotten a million like research grants and loans. He probably has some patents on some amazing technology that made him rich.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just like squandered the money away because, you know, like whatever his latest ventures were just didn't pan out, or he needed more time. And in the world of capitalism, you know, like I'm sure they don't
you
have
mean
like
the
much
world?
Well, you know, yeah, right, the entire Earth, like they don't have much patience for like a dreamer such as Reed, who needs time and like failures in order to achieve success.
Yeah.
So that's how Victor sort of has him like cornered. And I don't know, like I said, I think it's like a neat choice that the movie just starts kind of somewhere in the middle of the story,
mm-hmm,
with Reed Richards, like, because that was one of the biggest problems, and we'll get to it eventually, the Fantastic Four reboot, where you see them as teenagers.
Mm.
And that's kind of pathetic, like that.
Yeah,
you need the origin of all that, like right, exactly. Like here, they're adult. I mean, the Fantastic Four are supposed to be adults; they're not kids, and that's kind of what's interesting about them.
Right.
All right. So anyway, right. So
they make this deal that comes out terrible for Reed, but whatever. He's like, think of how many people we're going to help. It's fine.
Right. Yeah. Ben is suspicious this whole time. There's other like weird stuff, like where Victor is visibly afraid of Ben Grimm, even when he's a human, before he's the thing. Like, any time that Victor is on the verge of pushing Reed around, Ben sort of steps in Victor's eyeline, and Victor backs down very pathetically.
I didn't get the full backstory on Ben. He used to be, like, an army commander or something?
No, no,
or like...
he's an astronaut.
Oh, he was an astronaut.
Yeah,
okay.
Which I forget if Ben was an astronaut in the original comics. He might have just been Reed's friend. I'm not entirely sure. But I like this updating of Ben, too. He's not, like, an idiot. You know, although
right.
later when he becomes a thing, his intelligence, well, spoilers, like we're going to have to talk about like how his personality changes.
But he seems really like he's in charge of stuff and he knows what's going on and he's like smart about certain things.
He's very smart.
He's Ben.
I like this portrayal by Chiklis. I think there's like a lot of dimensionality to the human Ben Grimm to start. That's interesting. And he plays a lot of different notes.
They also allude to the fact that there's, like, a connection, like, Ben and Sue were friends from before, like, when they see each other for the first time in
they're
a
all
long time, supposedly.
I mean, they're all
friends, they have, like, a nice hug, like, greeting. And they allude to the fact that Ben used to be Johnny's...
Commander.
Right, okay.
Right. Yeah, so Ben was a NASA astronaut. Johnny was also an astronaut, but he washed out, as we'll get to. But they were all friends because Reed and Sue dated in MIT. They went to MIT and, you know, it was their social circle.
Mm-hmm.
The movie.
Oh, Sue went to MIT too?
Yes.
Okay.
But, you know, Victor Von Doom has some stipulations. One, he's going on the mission too, which kind of doesn't make sense. Like, why would he go, like, why? It doesn't make sense that Reed and company plus Victor are the pilots for this mission and the sort of workers. You think that people as smart and as sort of like high up the food chain of whatever companies they have, they wouldn't need to be physically on the mission, that they would have astronauts and scientists in their employ that would
well,
be the
Ben
ones
is the astronaut
space.
In Reed's employ.
He,
and Johnny
okay, yeah,
is the astronaut in Victor's employ.
Yeah, those two make
so
sense.
So you're saying
but
it doesn't
like,
make sense for Reed and Victor to go?
Not really, and doesn't make
so
much sense.
But Reed wants to do the science experiments himself, so...
Yeah, but you'd still think that there'd be more
really,
people...
Really, Victor's the only one that shouldn't be going.
I guess. I don't think any of them should be going to... I mean, Johnny and Ben, you can make the argument for, because they're pilots. But, like, you think that they... I think they would have underlings that would go on behest of some corporation to like, to actually do the experiments, and Reed would be controlling it from
the ground.
I don't know.
They get to go to space. That's, like, a cool perk of being the boss.
Yeah, it's fine. No, I'm willing to accept this. It just stuck out to me this time watching it. Like, why would all these principals be going? Anyway... Mm. So one of Victor's stipulations is that Johnny will be the command pilot for this mission, which irks Ben because he thinks Johnny, and rightfully so, is a hothead, like narcissist lunatic who washed out of NASA because he snuck lingerie models into a flight simulator and they somehow crashed the flight simulator, which I didn't realize that the flight simulator itself would be on wheels or something.
Yeah.
So we're introduced to Chris Evans as Johnny Storm. He's riding a motorcycle on a desert road and making out with some other girl on a motorcycle as they're driving. Which, I mean, they've updated the character for the 2000s. In the mm-hmm. 60s, he was similar. He was a real, like, hot rod motorcycle type guy who liked action and fun. You know, he was more like a beach boy, like in the early 60s of that, you know what I mean? Like that kind of like rebelliousness.
Here he's more of like a Top Gun Maverick type, like a Tom Cruise type.
Right. But updated for the 2000s. So he's got an embroidered leather jacket and, you know, his short cropped, George Clooney haircut. He's just like a big douchebag, but he's playing it. Like I said, he's playing the character to completion, and he's reflecting every inch of the zeitgeist of 2005, of mm-hmm. whatever that represented. So I think he's doing his job. Like, I can't... And he's watchable in the movie. He's playing a bad guy, but it's not like... it's unwatchable, mm-hmm. you know? He is hard to root for, though. So that's Johnny Storm. He's introduced. They're all hanging out in the NASA locker room somewhere. Or the Von Doom locker room at the launch site. One thing that I find just lame is they show Ben looking at a picture of himself and his wife, Debbie, the notorious Debbie, who we'll talk about in this film.
Right. They keep referencing her and talking about what a perfect couple they are, like what a perfect relationship
Ben
has.
Yeah, like everything is perfect. There's nothing wrong with them. He's like completely well-adjusted, you know, romantic man who loves his wife and believes in monogamy and, like, you know, I mean, like, there's nothing, and that's fine.
You don't like him petting the picture, though.
I don't like him petting the picture. He's petting a picture of his wife, which, I mean, actually, now that I think about it, I do like, because the famous meme or gif of Wolverine from the cartoon petting the picture of Jean Grey in his bedroom.
You've never pet a picture before?
I've never pet a picture of you or any of my other previous girlfriend. So, you know, you're getting a feel for the dynamic of the four. The movie, like, wastes no time in putting them all together, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny is an asshole ball buster. He comes in the room, makes fun of Ben. And I like that Ben doesn't really take the bait so much with Johnny. He's annoyed at him, but he's able to just...
Because he knows him really well. He knows that this guy's, like, just a ball buster, and he's like, all right, whatever.
And also, he's excited to flying into outer space again. He really appreciates his job. He's got a wonderful kind of life. And I like that about, like, there's some layers to Ben Grimm.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just like an immediate hothead, like wanting to punch Johnny in the face. He just can kind of take it and doesn't care about him. And then we get, you know, the introduction of the costumes.
Sue comes in and she's wearing the costume and she explains.
This is so bad. Everything with Sue is terrible in this movie.
Yeah, it's like unzipped enough that you see a lot of cleavage.
Yeah.
And she's like carrying a stack of the rest of the costumes and she explains how the fabric is made of unstable molecules, so it, like, I don't know.
I mean, it's the classic...
Does whatever your body
needs
it to do, basically, right?
It's the classic Marvel costume. I mean, it's the only unstable molecule explanation we've gotten in any Marvel movie, because this was a staple of the comic books.
Right.
So the comic characters, no matter what team, they have these magical costumes that conform to their skin, because the molecules, like, can adjust, you know, in real time to a person's body.
Right.
And it makes them very wearable and very comfortable to wear, despite them being completely skin tight and ridiculous. And in the comics, they're an invention of Reed Richards. In this movie, they say they were Victor's invention, which is fine to, like, invert that. That's not a big deal.
Right.
But
they all get a costume, and Reed is, like, blown away by the invention of this fabric. He's like, wow, that's so smart. And he's, like, staring at Sue as he's talking about it. And she starts passing out the costumes, and when she realized that he's impressed by
the
technology and not by
her banging bod,
yeah, she gets really upset.
I mean, yeah, she's like visibly upset that Reed doesn't notice how beautiful she looks in their work clothing, which is like, it's just pathetic that it was written that way. And I don't blame Jessica Alba for anything in this movie. I don't think it's her fault. It's just that her part is one of the worst written female parts of all time in any movie ever.
Yep.
So anyway, they get their, you know, Fantastic Four outfits. They don't have the four in them yet. It's kind of cute later how they do end up getting the four. I like that reveal. But they, you know, they're just sort of cutting quickly. They're on the space station. You see the shuttle dock with this cool futuristic, you know, like beyond like whatever International Space Station we have now kind of thing. And like we said, it has artificial gravity, and it's just the five of them. You know, it's the Fantastic Four plus Victor Von Doom. They're all working on this thing, and then, you know, you get some more backstory where Johnny and Ben, they're doing the mission where they're going to do a spacewalk and, it, you know, study the cosmic storm. Like, I guess Ben's mission is to put some flowers out there and to see how the flowers are going to react to, like, these cosmic forces. But in this whole time, Johnny and Ben are reminiscing about why Sue and Reed broke up. And, I don't know. So much of the script of this movie is dedicated to the relationship between Reed and Sue, and it's just not interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not done in a clever way. But I do kind of like the snappy rapport between Johnny and Ben. I think they're the best parts of the movie. That they're in the movie, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the other characters are not in the movie, but Johnny and Ben are they're doing the best they can. But anyway, you know, there's a miscalculation with the cosmic storm. It was supposed to come in like 2 days or something, but it's coming in like 10 minutes, and Reed has to interrupt Victor from proposing to Sue on the space station, which leads to some interesting questions.
Yeah, like, Sue doesn't seem to think that they're dating.
It's implied in the first scene when you're introduced to Sue that they are dating.
He just, like, stands really close to her. I don't know if there's really more implication than that. And it's also possible that he's just, like, posing that way in front of Reed to make him jealous, you know?
Yeah, and also...
But Sue seems, like, very confused about what's going on.
Yeah, she's just an employee of Victor Von Doom. And
also, Victor, like, links her employment to this proposal.
So disgusting.
He's like, consider this a promotion.
Oh my god.
Which is so, you know,
to me, what's disgusting about that is I bet that's, like, happened a billion times in human history, in recent human history too, of, like, high powered corporate moguls dating their secretaries and just the weird language they would use to talk about the merger of, you know,
just like coercion and getting these, yeah, getting them to do things that they don't want to do.
Well, I think a lot of women would want to do it, too. You know, like, if you're offered the chance to like, marry your billionaire boss and you skyrocket up the economic food chain.
Okay, I mean, maybe, but...
I just think the transactional nature... Right, I'm just saying it's bad. Like, whatever... I think it exists, though, is what I'm saying, too. Sue, though, has, like, some self-respect and is not interested in a man that she has no attraction to. She's not just... like, interested in his money and his status.
Well, we don't know, because she doesn't actually get to talk about it at all.
I think we know, because, like, so much of the movie, Sue is obsessed with making Reed notice her.
Right.
And she doesn't, like, really even think about Victor that much. Mm-hmm. But, anyway, Reed interrupts their moment. He wants to abort the mission. Victor's callous, though. He's saying, no, just pull them back. I'm not even sure, because, like, I thought... The idea was that if Reed aborted in that moment, then everyone would be safe. Mm-hmm. But Victor supports him, like, saving Ben and canceling the mission. He's just angry about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
I don't know.
Because later in the movie, they have a disagreement about it. Reed says, if you allowed me to abort sooner, we'd all be fine. And Victor says, I don't want to hear your excuses, kind of thing. Like, but in this moment, Victor seems to say, okay, reel him in and we'll get safe.
Right.
I mean, Victor does a shady thing later where they still haven't reeled in Ben yet.
And he just closes the shields.
Right. This space station has these shields that's supposed to protect him from cosmic radiation. The interesting thing is that the shields don't work.
Right.
Because Victor's protected, but he ends up getting magical powers,
too. They
all end up
getting irradiated, yeah.
Right. So the cosmic storm's coming. I think there was a funny moment where Ben's like, why are you worried, Reed? Because Reed's urging him to get back in. And Reed's like, just turn around and look. And I just think it's stupid that you could see the cosmic storm with your visible eyeballs.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would, like...
And that he didn't notice it sooner.
Right. But... I'm sure it would be invisible in real life, but, like, in the movie, it's like a big, raging, red thing of energy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's fine. I'm not nitpicking it, but still, you know, I don't know. The Fantastic Four, if you're going to do a Fantastic Four movie, it's supposed to be about science. I get that a lot of it is, like, magical sci-fi science, but... Maybe, like, in the future movies, try your best to, like bend reality as much as possible without breaking it.
Mm.
Just for the sake of science, because that's what's interesting about the comic.
It's a tough line to walk, apparently.
Yeah, it's a tough line to walk in the Marvel Universe. So, the cosmic storm breaks through, and it affects each character, and the audience gets a preview of their powers by virtue of how it messes up their bodies. Which I don't think, again, was entirely necessary. I think it's pretty
on the
stupid.
Nose. They could have saved themselves a minute or two of runtime here.
Yeah, it's so dumb to see, like, you know, Sue turns invisible for a moment as the storm passes through her. And, you know, Johnny catches on fire.
Right.
But anyway, you don't know what happens. Then it's like a hard smash to a hospital room. Ben wakes up. It's his point of view. And Johnny does a prank on him where he says, you've been hideously disformed. And Ben is obviously freaked out. He grabs a mirror, kind of like in the Joker, original Batman movie with the Joker. And he's fine. And he, you know, everyone's fine, right? Like,
everyone seems to be fine.
And I find this kind of, like, hard to believe because they're in one of Victor's, like, high-tech private hospitals in the mountains somewhere in the
Switzerland
Alps.
Or something.
Yeah, and there is a scene where the doctor is saying, like, all the results are normal for everybody, which... clearly can't be the case because later when a nurse checks Johnny's temperature, his temperature is like 209 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if the powers just needed like a few hours to come in.
The genetic mutation is happening.
Right. I guess it's happening like
as we speak.
Rapidly.
Yeah.
Everyone's okay. Another stupid thing about this movie is that the cosmic storm is what gives Reed his wingtips.
Those like silver streaks on the side of his hair.
Right. Which is like, come on, why not? You don't need to experience a cosmic storm to get gray in your hair. And it's like, and when he gets the gray, they don't even look that bold. In the comics, yeah, it's like he's got like noticeable. Two silver stripes that are very visible. In this movie, they're very like hard to even detect.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're thinking about that. Victor is not in the hospital for some reason. He's at a corporate board meeting. And because of this mission, his stock is plummeting, and they're going to give him 1 week to fix this, or else they're going to oust him from his own company. I don't understand why this failed mission would crash his stock, though. Do you have any speculation as to why?
I mean, his space station, like, blew up.
It didn't blow up.
Well, it was, like, infiltrated by these cosmic rays.
Yeah, but everyone
right?
on board is theoretically healthy.
Right.
Like, nobody died, you know.
But they didn't get the data that they needed.
But the data, I don't know. I mean, like
the mission was not a success.
Okay.
Right?
But, I mean, does that necessitate...
I feel like that is kind of the way the stock market works, no?
I don't know. I just think that, like, one... It doesn't... My point is, like, the mission doesn't seem, like, that bad of a failure. It just seemed like an aborted mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they collected some data that they might be able to use.
Who knows?
I don't know, right? It's ridiculous. It's just establishing the stakes of Victor's, like, losing his grip on all his precious control. Anyway, cut to Johnny Storm. He says he got a care package from his grandmother and very quickly, like, looks at a snowboard. Which, you know, I was, like, surprised that there was an explanation as to why there's a snowboard in his hospital room. I'm only mentioning that because I've always thought about that for years, and I couldn't believe that the movie actually does have an answer for it. That his grandmother sent him a snowboard.
Is he joking, or is he, like, being serious?
I mean, the point is he's saying that somebody got it to him,
right.
At the very least. Yeah. It doesn't have to be his grandmother. There's a beautiful nurse that he's hitting on relentlessly. He even, like...
He, like, kisses her real quick.
Uninvitedly kisses her on the lips. I mean, he's got so much swaggering, you know, energy.
This actress is familiar. Is she... I think she's the one that does, like, the movie trivia
Maria
the movie
Maria Menounos start. Or something?
Yeah.
It might be her.
Is that her?
I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
Anyway, they decide to go on a date where they're going to go, like, hella skiing in the Alps or wherever they are.
And she's, like, totally into it, you know, like, she
right.
like, jumps out of the helicopter before he does, and he's like, that's my future wife.
Yeah.
Stupid.
It's really dumb. I think that's the scene where they're skiing to the Sum 41 song.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, let's just talk about that whole scene, because we're going to be a little out of order here, but he catches on fire while snowboarding. He, you know, he burns off all his clothes and crash lands into a snowbank. And the woman skis down and discovers him in, like, a hot tub, naked.
Well, it's like he melted a bunch of the snow,
right.
Resulting in, like, a pool of water.
Yeah.
That he's sitting in.
And
he's like, why don't you join me?
Yeah,
and she's like, okay.
Yeah, she's like, she drops her skis very seductively, which is, I mean, everything about this woman, she just seems like the stupidest woman alive, which is a problem this movie has in general, is that the women characters are totally dumb.
Yep.
Like, she's a nurse, she's a trained nurse, she saw that he had a 209 degree temperature, which isn't normal, then she saw later that he's caught on fire. You'd think that she'd be sort of freaking out, like, what is wrong with you?
Or at least, like, medically interested.
Exactly, at the very least medically interested. No, she's like, oh, I'm horny, I'll have sex with you in the middle of nowhere and not ask
presumably.
Any questions. Right.
All right, then we cut back to what Ben and Sue and Reed are doing, and they all meet, quote-unquote, by accident in, like, the restaurant of some... Where are they even? Like,
they're
ski
in some,
lodge
like,
or
private
something?
Hospital that Victor owns.
Victor's private hospital has a restaurant with a huge dining
room. The location
room.
Of wherever this private hospital is kind of important, as we'll see later.
Right, so it was like Ben and Sue were meeting for dinner, and then Reed... just happens to be there, but really it's like a setup, right?
Yeah, Ben sets it all up. He wants, he's been pushing Reed to get back together with Sue because he wants him to have a normal life like him and Debbie.
Right.
And he's just, the way he just goes on and on about Debbie is kind of nauseating.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the payoff of the whole Debbie stuff is so absurdly ridiculous that it breaks the movie in my opinion.
Oh, we'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there.
So they all have like a nice dinner together.
They're laughing, you know.
And then his...
Reminiscing.
Yeah, Ben's stomach starts to grumble and he's like, oh, had some bad shrimp, I guess. Gotta go lay down, and leaves Reed and Sue to their own awkward conversation,
which is so bad. I mean, every conversation Reed and Sue have is awful.
She is so painted up in makeup, it's so distracting, and not just in this scene but like throughout, like in all the scenes, it's so distracting to look at her face.
And he said, you know, he's talking about their relationship, and he's like, you know, I'm happy that you and Victor are together. And she's put off by this because she's clearly not interested in Victor, because he's like, I know that you share that what we had, which is passion. And this, like, incredibly, for a moment, makes her so happy to hear. And then he corrects himself, passion for science.
Right. And she says, you don't get it, and you'll never get it unless it's explained in quantum physics.
It just makes her seem so stupid and dopey.
There's a line that just doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, I mean, just the idea that, like, he's supposed to be, like, Tom Hanks in Sleepless from Seattle or something. You know what I mean? Like, and she wants him to be Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And this idea that, like, I mean, the simplicity of her thought process when it comes to romance as a character in this movie
and
is
just
pathetic.
And that all she thinks about seemingly is this romance.
Yeah, right. And Reed is clueless as to reading any signals from her.
It makes them really boring to watch, but
boring and predictable and just dated and sad.
Right. So, anyway, they start, like, kind of discovering their powers.
Yeah.
Their genetic mutation is taking effect,
so,
I guess.
So she turns invisible, and Reed says, I can't see you. And she, again, thinks it's, like, another, like, sign of Reed's shitty romance.
Right. But then realizes
that, like, how typical of you not to see me. Look at me.
Right.
And he's like, no, look at your hands, you idiot.
Right. And she realizes, like, oh, it's literal.
Right.
And we see Reed, like, stretching for the first time. So, I mean,
she knocks over a wine bottle, and he stretches out with his arm to get it. And, you know, the CGI in Reed Richards looks really bad in this movie. It looks really bad in the rebooted movie 10 years later in 2015, mm-hmm. which makes me think that, like, they're never going to make convincing CGI for the Reed Richards powers. It's always going
to
look
like
a shitty cartoon.
How could they make a practical costume to accomplish this? It makes me picture, like, Stretch Armstrong material. Did you ever have one of those as a kid?
You're gonna have to watch the Roger Corman movie to see how they do it. They build, like, a bunch of fake, like, extendo arms made of, you know,
oh, I see,
plastic,
yeah,
with springs in them.
They should have done Stretch Armstrong. That would have been cooler.
Right, like, build, like, some fake rubber thing.
Yeah, just, well, give him, like, an arm attachment out of that material.
I don't
whatever
think they're ever going to figure out a way to do, a prosthetic live-on-film Reed Richards. It's always going to be CGI. And, like, yeah, I said, I just have the suspicion that it's never going to look good.
Yeah.
Even if they put, like, they render it as best as they can. It's just, there's something so cartoony about a man who could bend his every, like, part of his body that it's just never going to be believable.
Yeah. Meanwhile, cut to Victor.
Although his powers are very cool, though. That's sort of, like, the inverse problem, is that he has amazing powers.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things where, like, his powers are kind of goofy on the surface, but, like, part of the fun of superheroes, like, including Spider-Man, we've talked about this, is, like, the creative ways that they figure out to use their powers in strange situations.
Yeah.
So just, it's not just that he can bend and stretch. It's things like, you know, being able to create a hole in his stomach so that something sharp doesn't impale him.
Right. I mean, honestly, he's got one of the most amazing power. It's the way Jack Kirby and Stan Lee dreamed up different ways he could use his powers is one of the reasons why the Fantastic Four comic was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Because he can, like, stretch himself out to be, like,
a parachute. Yeah.
He can make himself into, like, weird shapes. Like, he can make his whole body, I think, into, like, a key or something.
Hmm.
Or, I mean, his fingers anyway. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he could do, like, all sorts of, like mind-bendingly weird things. I think, like, even they talk about how he could stretch his body out to, like, the thinnest of molecules to be, like, this almost invisible layer or something. Like, I mean, there's, like, all sorts of, like, weird stuff he could do. They also speculate that it allows his brain to stretch more, too, which gives him increased brain power. I just remember, like, it's very fascinating. But in a movie, it just doesn't look that great. At least not in the hands of these creators.
Yeah.
So maybe in the future someday they'll, like, make it look better and, like, be more satisfying to witness. But I don't know. This movie just looks bad. All right. So he can stretch. He can turn invisible. Johnny comes back to the hospital. He's naked, but he realizes he's got fire powers. You know, he can control it with the snap of his fingers.
Right.
Although not entirely. A big plot line in the movie is that, like, he thinks he can fly, but he's not, like, quite sure how to start it or to control it.
Right. Meanwhile, Victor is also experiencing some symptoms. He's, like, pulling out chunks of hair that's just, like, falling out of the back of his head, I guess. And there's some, like, electromagnetic field distortions or something going on.
Around his hands and body.
Yeah, like electricity shooting out from weird places, or he affects the light fixtures wherever he is.
It's some pretty gross body horror with him.
Like, like later they show like piece, like chunks or like slivers of metal he's like pulling out of his gash in his head. That was like a weird one because it's like at first it seems disgusting.
It looks
but
like a staple he's pulling out. But
also, there's something kind of like cool about it. I don't know.
I think it's not bad. I don't like that this movie and the reboot felt that they had to transform the Doctor Doom character into like a metal man.
Yeah.
I think they should. The comics thing is so much more interesting that he's got a scarred face and that's why he wears a big
the metal mask.
Metal mask, because he's so vain that he can't let anyone see imperfection on his appearance.
Yeah.
And also in the comics too, his metal suit is like filled with technology like Batman or Iron Man. You know, he's got like lasers in his hands and like a computer in his on his wrist and like all sorts of like crazy stuff that like fits the character of being a mad scientist. That's why he wears the suit. He doesn't need to be made of metal for me to, like, buy, like, some kind of reality that they're going for.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I don't know.
I would easily just think that Dr. Doom would invent a glove, a metal glove that can shoot lasers, as opposed to needing to make his hands metal and conduct electricity to shoot laser beams.
Right, fine. I mean, in the beginning here, when he's just discovering these powers, like, he doesn't really know what he has yet.
Right.
If I were him, like, he's got this whole team of medical staff, like, on demand.
Yeah.
He needs medical attention. Like, there's nothing good coming out of it yet, but he's just kind of, like, skulking in the shadows, like, always.
He's just, like, he's concerned with the his company and
the stock investors, whatever.
Yeah, so he doesn't care about his own physical well-being at this point yet. But anyway, so he's been transformed too. And
Ben is also starting to transform.
Well, his transformation is much more dramatic and horrible.
Yeah, he's in like his, he's back in his room because he was having stomach pains at dinner. That was for real. He wasn't just like trying to get out of there. But yeah, he undergoes like a horrible werewolf transformation into.
You don't see it yet. Reed uses his powers to like slide his arm underneath the door to unlock the key. I did like, there's a couple of these moments I did like. There's a lot of genuine surprise in the actors' faces when they're all showing their powers to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they get sort of, like, they're so sort of stunned by what's happening that they register some believable moments. And that's kind of like, you know, there's a lot of charm in this movie. I think that it's not quite as bad as I remembered it. It's actually, there's like, I think there's like a framework of a good movie here. I think a lot of the sort of the updating and modernizing the story works. And I think it's just like the inevitable scenarios they put them in don't like amount to much, and they're just kind of ridiculous, and that's kind of the problem of the movie. It doesn't have good set pieces, and the plot kind of ends up going nowhere. But in general, like, there's a lot of like good little moments. Like, a lot of it reminded me of Ghostbusters, mainly because a bunch of them are scientists, right?
Right.
And it's a whole bunch of scientists sort of like having that like insane reaction to ridiculous phenomenon face to each other, and they're sort of like, you know, marching along trying to figure out what's wrong with them and like what to do next. So, and you know, a lot of it takes place in New York City, so there was like, there was a little bit of Ghostbusters in this movie, and I think that's good. You know, I like Ghostbusters. But anyway, Ben, he's like, they all look at him, he's like jumped out of the window and he's running in the woods, and someone's like, where's he going? And Reed says, the only place he knows, home. Which is a horrible line.
Then we see the Brooklyn Bridge.
So somehow, like, So this is a very mysterious part of the movie. They cut to a train yard. At first, I thought it was a shipyard, which would have made a little bit more sense. And he busts out of a cargo container. So either way, he shipped himself back to New York City. But
not sure how he got there,
but
okay.
I think it's on a train though. Where is the hospital? What's the closest like Alp skiing type mountain range to New York City that Ben Grimm could get from, you know?
We just assumed it was Switzerland or something. They don't say it. I don't think it could have been anywhere.
It could have been Colorado,
like the United States or Canada or something. Yeah. Who knows?
It's hard to say. But Ben somehow makes it back to New York City, and he goes to whatever neighborhood he lives in. I tried to figure out where he's shown to be living here, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. In the comics, he's from, like, Yancey Street, which I guess it's fictional.
A fictional Marvel thing, but supposed to be on the Lower East Side.
Right.
But here they say he's from Brooklyn, so I don't know.
Well, yeah, so the character says he's from Brooklyn in the movie, but I know Jack Kirby based the thing on himself. He based Ben Grimm, the character, his backstory on himself, and Jack Kirby was from the Lower East Side, and he fought in a lot of gangs and stuff as a kid.
Hmm.
So, I don't know. But anyway, he's in New York City somewhere. He calls his wife on a payphone, tells her to meet him outside the apartment, and we're introduced to Debbie.
She comes outside in her lingerie dress,
which is
thing,
insane.
And she like does. They don't even exchange words. She's just like, "Is that you?" And then she like gets scared and runs.
He's like,
away.
"Don't run away! Something happened to me."
But I'm still me, and she's not having it.
She screams and runs away. Okay, I mean, I could maybe forgive this interaction.
Because it's the first time and she's shocked, right?
Right. Like, he literally is, in this universe, there's been no other monsters in human history up to this point that we know of, right? Like, it's reality. And he is a monster. So I could see her being scared.
Yeah. But he finds this whole interaction depressing, obviously.
Like, super
because
depressing.
This is his love. I mean, obviously this is not as perfect a relationship as it was made out to be.
Well, it's hard to say. In the past, it was really hard on Debbie, like, from the jump. Like, you know, just her being, like, not having any curiosity about, like, what's wrong with him.
He's obviously, like, he's not threatening her. He's, like, keeping a distance so she can get used to what he looks like.
She knows it's him. Or maybe she could think it's, like, a trick, you know, on her, like, some monster is pretending to be her husband.
Maybe.
I think we can forgive Debbie in scene one here.
Okay,
for just being scared. Like, whatever, you know.
He gets kind of depressed, though. He goes to sit on, presumably, the Brooklyn Bridge.
I think it's the Brooklyn Bridge. Is he there to kill himself, or is he just hanging out?
No, I think he's just hanging out. I mean, it's funny. With,
that's kind of weird that he's doing that.
The costume. Well, where's he going to go, I guess? You know,
I guess.
He wants to be away from people.
He needs to be isolated.
Yeah, he just wants to be alone. Yeah. And, like, a pigeon poops on him, and he, like, wipes it off.
He wipes
easily.
It off very well, which like, is very striking. It's something I noticed
every
time.
You can
tell that
it's a rubber suit and not, like, a stone suit.
Yeah.
It's funny. But he, like, stops this guy from jumping. This, you know, apparently this guy's going to commit suicide by jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge. And he stops him from doing it, but the guy kind of, like, backs away from him on one of those, like, high beams above traffic.
Right.
Ends up, like, falling into
monster.
The traffic. Ben has to, like, jump in there after him. I mean, he's trying to prevent one death, but he ends up probably causing, like, many others.
It looks like a lot of people must have died from all of this.
This crash is, like, insane, like, really huge.
Yeah. I think this is where the, like, I know there's been comic elements in this movie, mainly with Johnny Storm up to this point, but now that, like, they've decided to play the thing as a total joke from here on out.
Right.
Which I get was, like, part of the comics, that thing was the comic relief, but not entirely. Like, the thing was also the tragic character, and, like, that's where they could get a lot of the pathos out of the comic line,
mm-hmm.
because he was just so depressed about his lot in life and being transformed hideously in the way he was. But in the movie, decides mainly to say that this is all a big joke, that he's this rock monster guy. And as we alluded to earlier, something, like, clearly changes in the way Chiklis plays the thing. When he's the rock monster, he's, like, his IQ's, like, visibly drops
mm-hmm.
at least 20 points. He's way stupider, and even the way he speaks is he goes from being, like, an almost savvy, you know, like, wizened astronaut character to now being a, like, a dopey New
it's
Jersey,
like Tony Soprano.
Like, yeah, not even Tony Soprano, like, a stupider guy in his crew.
Right.
It's, like, it's kind of, it's weird. It's just so strange that he's, like, just outright dumber as the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, but at the same time, Chiklis does capture, like, the comic element of the thing. You know, he does capture the sort of dopey New York humor aspect of him.
I mean, we also get some tragic moments from him.
Yeah,
where
but
he kind of explains, like, oh, this is my lot, like, this sucks, you
in,
know?
In the final wash, they play it all for laughs. And the movie, and starting with this bridge disaster scene, is all played as this, like, now it's like a madcap comedy movie.
Yeah, the next thing that happens is that, like, Sue Reed and Johnny happen to be in a taxi cab crossing the Brooklyn Bridge at this moment.
And they let out a vital piece of exposition I never noticed before, where they say, like, we agreed to meet Debbie on the other side of the bridge. Because
mm-hmm.
I always want, because Debbie appears at the end of the scene, and I was like, how did Debbie just show up to break up with Ben and not say anything else and run away? Like, it never made sense, but now at least they're giving some kind of explanation of why Debbie's there in the first place.
It is just a coincidence that, like, they happened to be crossing at the same time that Ben was sitting there, but whatever.
Right.
So they, like, get out of this taxi cab because of this huge traffic pileup accident thing. And Reed is like, oh, gosh, we're never going to be able to get through this crowd. But you can, Sue, because you can turn invisible. And she's like, oh, right.
This so, is so incomprehensible, this scene.
So incomprehensible. She turns herself invisible.
You see her, like, she's still wearing her clothing, though.
And he's like, you gotta lose the clothes, Sue. We can see your clothes. And she's like, oh, right. So she strips down to her underwear and then, like, turns back into, like, she goes uninvisible again.
So you get a brief shot of Jessica Alba in her underwear, which is exploitative and pointless.
Right.
I mean, I'm not, like, that
but then she, like,
much of a school marm where I think, like, they shouldn't have done this, you know?
I think they shouldn't have done this. It serves no purpose in the story.
Except to humiliate the character.
Right.
So she's humiliated, but she goes invisible.
She turns invisible again. She takes off her underwear, leaves it in a pile, and Johnny picks it up for her so she can put it back on later. But then we see her making her way through the crowd as she's invisible, but she still has to be like, excuse me, pardon me, make way. Like, why did she have to be invisible for that to happen?
Yeah, she could have just pushed her way through the crowd as
a
normal
person.
It would have
been more effective and less confusing.
And then we see Reed and Johnny make their way through the crowd with no problem, too. Like, none of it makes sense.
Yeah.
It was just a scene to get Jessica Alba in her underwear in a public place. It's stupid.
Right. Okay. Anyway, they're on the other side of it. And, like, explosions are starting to happen because of, like, all the cars crashing into each other.
I mean, the police are shooting at the thing. You see he's bulletproof. They save a bunch of firefighters. A fire truck is about to go over the bridge. They all use their powers to do it.
The cops surround Ben at
the end
of it.
There's a scene where I think Johnny would have incinerated that little girl he rescues. Like, the explosion is happening, and Johnny turns his back into fire. But somehow that protects the girl he's holding in the front of his body. I don't really understand that. But she's safe. Okay, whatever.
Fine.
He absorbs the heat and fire, I guess.
Right. The cops, like, have been surrounded. And they're
going to shoot him. And then the firefighters forcibly put their hands on the cops' guns to make him not shoot. Which, this is, like, the first instance of, like, some relevant 2020 shit, I thought.
Yeah.
Of showing that, like, insane, like, how insane police officers are. They're just ready to
shoot something
they don't understand. Right.
Yeah,
trained to kill. And, like, a sensible firefighter is like, what the fuck are you doing
with
your dumbass
gun? Cheering crowd of people all around. Like,
and the only way the firefighters
Ben
get away with this action is because it's, like, post 9/11 and firefighters are gods in New York at this time. And you know what I mean? They're, like, true heroes.
Right.
So I just thought, like, that's some weird, like, I don't think it was social commentary relevant to the time in 2005, but it is weirdly, it's like a relevant scene now to see, like, another, like, New York City municipal worker forcibly lower the guns of police officers.
Mm. This is the point where Debbie shows up. We see her in the crowd, not sure exactly how she got there.
Deb, don't run.
And, like, without a word, she just takes off her wedding ring and puts it on the ground
and runs
leaves.
Away. I mean, this is fucking nuts. I mean, first of all, Debbie's got to know who Reed Richards is, right? He's the smartest man alive. Don't you think she'd want to at least talk with Reed?
And Reed and Ben have been friends for, like, many years, presumably.
Right.
Like, she knows him
for sure.
She
has to know all these people.
But there's no dialogue. Like, she doesn't have a conversation with anybody.
No question. She's like, maybe it's not permanent. Like, wouldn't you, like, this is my husband. Like, wouldn't she be asking, like, maybe it'll go away. Is that going to
And she
happen?
Knows that Reed is, like, a brilliant scientist.
Right.
Like, her first question should be, like, can you do anything to help him?
Yeah. The fact that she wordlessly breaks up with her husband, who she supposedly had this perfect marriage with, is so just, like, comically awful.
Ben,
it just speaks to, like, Ben must have been a moron to think that they had a perfect marriage. I mean, like, I don't... How could this be a deal breaker? Like, her husband has just been mutilated in an accident.
Right, he's
and
the victim.
And this is the card she shows.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it's
some
not...
Some support network.
Right, like, it's not like she has to, like, have sex with him or anything. She just has to be there for him, or at least ask questions and have a conversation with him and her friend. Right. I mean, just none of it makes sense.
Right. They play the scene for laughs a little bit, though. Ben goes over and tries to pick up the ring, but his fingers are so, like, fat and rocky that he can't.
I didn't think this was for laughs. I thought that this was tragic. Okay. This is like tragic body horror.
I feel like they were like making fun of him, sort of, with his rubbery fingers. Reed has to go and like pick up the ring and give it to him. And at that moment, he like swears to do everything possible in his power with his last dying breath. He'll be there for Ben finding a cure.
And that's true of the comics. It's like one of the things Reed can never like manage to do is cure Ben. He like comes close a million times and it like never quite works, or it's never permanent. I don't know if like that's a thing they just abandoned in the comic at a certain point. It might just be like in the movie. At the end of this movie, spoilers, Ben's like, I'm happy being the thing, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I bet in the comics at some point he's just the same attitude. Mm. He's like, the thing is who I am, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird with this, with the scale of the thing in this movie. It's hard to tell. Like, I feel like in the cartoons, he's noticeably, like, much larger, like, taller.
He's wider. I don't think he's supposed to be that tall as the thing.
Okay.
He's definitely, like, wider and, like, less human size. I mean, because he's wearing a costume, so they can't...
Yeah, yeah.
They can't elongate
it. They don't make him taller. They just make him, like, his fingers are thick and...
Yeah.
I
think it's a good costume. Like, I don't...
Yeah, yeah.
I think for what it is, it's fine. It's, if it was a better movie, I think it would be, like, a smash hit.
Yeah. And, like, we see the Fantastic Four standing around, and Johnny looks at him, and he's like, where are your ears? You know, it's one of those,
like... That's a funny question.
It becomes, like... That's, like, the hallmark humor of Marvel going forward, actually. You know, where they, like, call attention to stuff like that.
I think that was clever. I think there's a lot of... There is some clever dialogue in this movie, mainly between Johnny and Ben, more than anyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now it's like they go to the Baxter building. They all agree they're going to live there until Reed can cure them all. It's not just curing Ben. They all want, like, to have a normal life, except for Johnny, who thinks that it's amazing to be a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then there's, like, a whole scene where they... This is part of the comic, too, is that the Fantastic Four are celebrities.
Right.
And that, like, the world kind of loves them inexplicably for some reason, unlike the X-Men, who are hated and feared.
Their whole scene where they were, like, saving people ended up on TV.
Right, and people didn't, like, they didn't blame them for the 50 people that died.
Right, even though it was technically Ben's fault, but whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean...
Oh, we get, like, the funny little Stan Lee cameo here when they go into the Baxter building.
He's the mailman. I think the
character... Mailman Willie.
Willie Lomax might be the full name. So Stan Lee gets... He gets a more extended... cameo in the sense that he's playing an actual character from the comics, not just being himself appearing.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll come back in the second one too, but obviously. Anyway, so the Baxter building, pretty cool that the Baxter building's in the movie. It's just like this weird inexplicable skyscraper that Reed
owns. It's
like
a beautiful Art Deco building.
Yeah. And it's like the top floors of it are like all his amazing science equipment. It's been hollowed out. You know, it's like part apartment, and then in the middle of it is his... Like, you know, he's got a... It's, like, sort of, like, hollowed out to the roof.
Right.
You know, they do a lot of good stuff with the thing, where he can't get on the elevator, so he has to take the stairs every time. I guess that's a joke they repeated in Avengers Endgame with the Hulk, that they didn't let the Hulk on the elevator, he had to take the stairs.
Yeah, that's right.
But, I mean, there's a lot of, like, nice touches with the thing. That's, like, but they just don't get the tone right, because half the time they're playing him for laughs, and half the time they're trying to do the tragic thing. And it's just, like, I don't know, it doesn't... Never jives correctly. So here's where some other, like, weirdly relevant 2020 stuff happens, and let's try to, like, to push our way to the end here, you know? I know we've done a lot of setup, but, like, really the movie just kind of falls apart after this point anyway, like, nothing happens, basically. The 2020 stuff is that they've all decided they need to quarantine themselves in the Baxter building.
Well, specifically, Sue makes them quarantine. She's like, you guys are all over the news, and, like, she tries to go out in public, but, like, she gets recognized, and a crowd starts chasing her, and she turns invisible and strips her clothes off to get away from them.
Again.
And that's the point where she realizes, like, we have to just stay inside. So she essentially enforces a quarantine for all four of them. But it doesn't go that well. Like, they start going crazy, kind of just like, there's like a little montage scene of like Johnny playing
pranks.
Practical jokes on Ben and whatever, like, okay, fine. But like at a certain point, you know, they get sick of it. Also,
Johnny hates the quarantine. He wants to go on TV and be like a motorcycle celebrity.
Wait, there's one part that's like really horrible before that I just have to say. There's like a little, also a montage of them. Like, Reed is testing the extent of all their powers. So, like, with Johnny and Ben, it's pretty straightforward, right? Like, Johnny goes into some, like, temperature-controlled chamber so he can get as hot as possible.
And he can get as hot as the surface of the sun,
right,
apparently.
Guess what? He's really hot. Okay. Yeah. Ben, you know, they do, like, what do you call it, like the reflex test on his knee, and they have to like pound it with a hammer, but and then he gets the reflex, like, okay, he's made of rock. Cool. Even his organs and blood vessels are made of rock.
The movie does raise a question about the thing's skin.
Yeah.
In that, like, what does he feel when people touch him?
They don't outright say, but it seems relevant later.
He does have stimulus to being touched, though, which is weird.
Right. That is weird to try to imagine how a rock feels.
Yeah. Okay. Go on, though. I think I know what you're going to talk about.
We don't really get into the extent of Reed's powers. We don't see him really like running experiments.
We just show him reaching for toilet paper across the apartment.
Right. So, okay, he's stretchy. Then when it comes to Sue, and he's trying to figure out like what triggers her powers, it turns out that it's like an emotional trigger, and that like when she was on the bridge the first time, when she ever became invisible in public, she was accessing these feelings of like anger and rage, mm-hmm. but she's having trouble like always controlling when she goes invisible and not. And Reed just says like,
he says your powers are triggered to your emotions or connected to your emotions, and she takes this so stupidly.
He doesn't say it exactly like that. It's like implied like she's too emotional, like, oh, the woman is too emotional and she needs to work on her self-control,
right,
in order to be able to gain control of her powers. And
all this does is anger her.
Right, exactly. And then she's like, it gets out of control and she's too emotional again.
Oh man, it's just really bad. I mean, like, you get to see that she's got force field power as well.
Yes.
Which I guess you saw in the other scene too, but whatever. It's like any scene with Sue is just
bad.
It's just so mind-numbingly awful, and it was awful in the time too. I don't think when this movie came out people ignored it. I think they noticed how terrible Jessica. I think she was nominated for a Razzie for this. So.
She was. I mean, it's like you said. I feel bad that she's blamed for
it. The script literally gives her nothing but all
this
like
petty
bullshit.
The plot points are just that way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like you can't even tell if her acting is good or bad because the plot points are so egregious.
It's terrible. All-time worst superhero character portrayal.
Right.
Meanwhile, Victor, he's being transformed more. His body's getting more metal. He kills a doctor who tells him that he's got a disease and he needs to be quarantined himself.
The doctor like wants to notify the CDC because he's worried that this is like a progressive, progenerative, contagious disease that might spread to other people.
Yeah.
And Victor's like, nope, and just like kills him.
So anyway, like, I mean, there's a lot of just the idea that these people are going stir crazy being quarantined and they want to venture out into the real world, even though it's not safe. Again, there's some weird, relevant COVID shit. This movie is a strange sort of, like, allegory for what we're going through.
I think we're just, like, reading into it because that's our current situation,
well,
so that's where our minds are at.
What else do we have when it comes to this movie?
So, you're right.
The fact that it's giving us this, at least, is like, it, to me, it was moderately interesting watching it.
Yeah.
And I think it, like, it does make it, I bet, like, some, like, more popular media source than us is going to make this connection at some point and write an article about it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, the idea is they're quarantining together until Reed can build like a storm chamber.
Right, to recreate the storm, but reverse it. You reverse the wave particles.
Right. Good science.
And Johnny like goes to he breaks the quarantine, goes to some ESPN extreme sports motorcycle contest, and he does some stunts and he's out of his mind. But there, like when he burns his motorcycle costume off, you see that he's got the four now on his chest, and Jessica Alba is sort of outraged at this. And later it's like, it shows that it's like, whose idea was this? And Reed slowly covers his own, cause it was Reed's idea to make them into superheroes.
Right.
I mean, despite this movie being bad and like I said, being filmed in the cultural desert that was 2005, it's watchable. I don't know why. Like, the characters are likable enough.
Mm.
You're kind of like, they do enough establishing the world and the stakes that it's like, you just kind of want to see what happens next. And the subplot of the thing is, like, interesting enough, too, where you're just, like, you sympathize enough with him, you know?
Yeah. Well, actually, at this point, the thing also is tired of being in quarantine. He can't take it anymore. So he goes out. He goes to, like, his favorite bar in Brooklyn, I guess. and
that's where he meets Alicia, played by Kerry Washington.
Right. She has to feel him up in order to quote unquote see him because she's blind. And this is the point where we're like, can he feel that she's touching him?
Well, he's shuddering like he's getting an orgasm or something.
Really?
The look on his face, his breath has taken away. She's feeling his chest in his face.
I thought he was just surprised that she was doing that.
I mean, it's a combination of surprise but arousal. It's very strange.
Weird.
It's weird. But again, this is from the comics, so, I mean, Alicia's a big part of the thing's life. I'm not, going to be so hard on that.
Right. Then, Sue gets tired of her own quarantine restrictions and decides to take Reed out on a date to the planetarium.
She's still trying to bag Reed.
And they have, this whole reminiscing scene at the planetarium, remembering, their first date was there, I guess.
It's worth noting, too, that Victor has security cameras in the Baxter building and has been spying on them this entire time and, knows all their secrets. And he knows that he's lost Sue and that she loves Reed.
And he's pissed.
He has another line, too, when you're talking about, she's an object and his sniveling toad assistant's like, I don't understand why you want Sue, sir, when you can have any other woman in the world.
Right.
And he says, that's
she's exactly the only why. Thing I can't have.
Right. It's because I could have any other woman. Yeah, I mean, it's just, whatever. He's just jealous of Reed, I guess. That's the suggestion of that. I mean, we do get our first Latveria reference when Victor ambushes, the guy who is one of the board members and kills him. It's you can always move back to Latveria, the old country, and start over. Which raises more questions than the film would dare answer about, what...
they don't have time to get into
what
that.
Is Victor's, role in Latveria? Was he the king of Latveria? Nobody knows.
What even is Latveria? They don't talk about it.
I think it would be, a cool, interesting thing to, pursue, because you do have, in Saudi Arabia, you've got, a million crown princes, and they're all fabulously wealthy. You know, they're all billionaires in their own right. And I'm sure a lot of them have their own businesses and stuff. So I think maybe Victor's one of those types of guys. He's part of some dynastic line, and he's been given his own billion-dollar package to start a company in America. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of not worked out. And I think you could have done some interesting Latverian politics if the film dared try. But...
yeah, I mean, again, this is an early superhero movie, right?
Right.
So instead of spending time on that, what they do spend time on is... contriving fights amongst the Fantastic Four themselves.
That also feature product placement for Burger King.
Right. There's a fight between Johnny and Ben using their powers, and then there's another fight between, Reed and Ben using their powers, and it's that kind of fan service that, Civil
lame.
War did a lot of, where it's just that fans want to see,
the heroes
the
fight.
Matchup.
Yeah.
And it does nothing to further the story.
And it also looks bad, and it's not interesting in the slightest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Ben punches Johnny into a flame-broiled Burger King advertisement.
Right.
There's a lot of dumb product placement in this movie, actually.
Yeah.
But they're trying to make it, I think in the sequel they make more of a big deal of that Johnny wants the Fantastic Four to sell out to these companies.
Right. Well, there's, also a little joke in there at some point where, Johnny, comes back to the Baxter building and runs into Ben in the lobby, and Johnny's got a prototype for the Thing action figure.
Right. Which
and
looks like the comic book. It doesn't look like the Thing in this universe, because in the action figure he's holding has the extended brow that the Thing has.
And when you press a button, it says it's clobberin' time,
right.
Which is not currently a catchphrase that the Thing uses.
Right.
But then later on in a different fight, he uses that catchphrase.
I guess he's using it ironically.
From the action figure. Right. So it's like a chicken and egg scenario.
Yeah. I guess he's saying it ironically or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, what else is going on? I mean, so this movie, it just sputters to its end. Victor, he manipulates Ben into, forcing Reed to finish the machine that's going to cure him. And Reed takes an unnecessary... Because Reed feels guilty now that he's been on a date with Sue, he jumps into the machine himself to try to cure himself, and it just makes him worse. His whole face, droops
droopy.
Off, and his arms. It's actually pretty, scary and... Again, some more body horror there. But it is literally something of, where he gets cured of that in, 5 minutes. Mm. Anyway, so Sue has to take Reed to get him some bed rest. And that's where Victor shows up in the Baxter building and confronts Ben. He's like, hey, I can actually cure you right now. I know what's wrong with the machine. It doesn't have enough power. So Ben takes a chance on this, and Victor cures him.
Yeah. This reminded me a little bit of the Secret Wars in Spider-Man, how... Von Doom allies with the Thing and cures him, you know?
It's a good plot device.
Yeah.
It's clever, and I like that. There's a cool scene where...
And it also makes you, like, you're sympathetic to Ben still. It's not like Ben is turning to the dark side or anything like that.
No. He just wants his life to be saved.
Yeah.
And I like the scene where Victor rips open the containment field for the cosmic storm and sticks his hand in there to shoot more electricity into it.
Yeah.
I thought that was, like, hilarious and, like, totally weird.
Uh-huh.
And so Ben's cured, and then, like... You know, Ben has, like, a good heart. He goes to Victor, he's like, you can cure yourself, too, now.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, Victor bitch slaps him and almost kills him. And he's trying to eliminate the Fantastic Four. I'm not, like, entirely sure why he needs to kill all these people.
He just wants revenge, that's all.
He just wants revenge on Reed, I guess, to ruin Reed's life.
And on Sue, because she rejected him, maybe.
Yeah, so, like,
That's the next fight that we see, actually.
That's why this movie sucks, ultimately, is because the final fight and the stakes between Doctor Doom and the Fantastic Four are so petty and boring, you know?
Yeah.
Like, nothing, like, it's basically Victor just wants petty revenge on Reed. He doesn't want to take over the world. He's not trying to, like, steal some magical science from him. He's just upset that Reed stole his girlfriend.
And was more successful in school.
It's not like he even wants revenge for his, like, body being destroyed. He's happy about it.
Yeah. He likes his new superpowers.
Right.
Him and Johnny are the only two that, like, are into it. They want to stay the way they are, basically.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you know, Ben has been, like, slapped and thrown across the room. Reed is still, like, drooping. He can't really fight right now. So Sue tries to fight Victor.
He's not quite drooping. I don't know what's wrong. Reed's just sort of... I'm not quite sure what the deal with Reed is at this point.
Well, because he turns out to be fine.
He can't fight very effectively.
Whatever
he did in the cosmic storm thing, it didn't hurt him.
He like droops out the window or something. I don't know.
Well, that might be just because Reed gets shot by Victor's electricity.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if like that's the reason why.
Oh yeah, Victor's like, what happens to rubber when you superheat it?
Yeah.
Implying that it's gonna like melt him.
So he already was. So there's something just weird where he already was drooping, but now he's like being melted by Victor.
Right. So then Sue comes in and tries to fight Victor. Turns out she's totally useless in a fight. She, like, does not hold up well against him at all. And
all her lines of dialogue with Victor when she's fighting him are so horrible.
Yeah. Anyway, the fight ends up, like, going out into the streets. Victor's, like, shooting electricity around. His hands are just kind of at his sides. Like, there's nothing
really... He doesn't raise his hands to shoot. He, like,
it's
just...
Weird.
I wish he just raised his hands to shoot them. I don't know why. I think that visually would be more interesting and more powerful looking than just sort of, like, casually leaving them by his hips. But
Ben is still up there, like, in the Baxter Building penthouse, and he sees his three friends starting to fight. And
he's a normal man, and he seemingly also seems to have his normal personality again.
Right, he's been cured. Yeah. He's smart again, and he's cured. Yeah. And he decides to jump back into the machine and turn himself back into the Thing so that he can go and help his friends fight.
Wow, what amazing that the machine this time, too, instead of giving him some new random powers, he gets his Thing powers back. And also it's weird that he instantly becomes a Thing, like, right away as opposed to before when it took, like, a week for him to transform.
Also, just what a bad decision.
Very bad decision, very stupid. I mean, come on.
But... Anyway, the four of them, then, the Fantastic Four, are reunited on the street, and they're fighting against Victor.
Well, you skipped
Victor.
A scene where, like, Victor was freezing Reed to death.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But Sue saved
him. What happens to rubber when you super cool it?
Right, yeah. I thought it looked visually interesting, though.
It becomes brittle.
When he looks like he's all frozen over and nearly dead, and Victor's sort of hovering over him. Oh, and Victor, at this point, he's put on the Doctor Doom mask he got from the citizens of Latveria, and he's wearing a green cape.
No, he stole it from the lobby of the Baxter Building.
Oh, that was in the Baxter Building?
I think so.
I think it was in his own building. There's two buildings.
Oh,
his skyscraper overlooks the Baxter Building. I think that's where he gets his outfit from.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. So they all end up on the street. They're,
like,
united.
You would think that, like, four superheroes against one villain would be not that big of a problem, but it is.
I mean, Dr. Doom's overpowered. I mean, I kind of get it. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, they haven't been trained to fight. They don't know karate or anything.
Yeah, that's true.
They're just sort of using their intelligence to use their powers to stop
him.
Oh,
yeah, that's true. There was no, like, training scene here. That's, like, one of those tropes that they always put in the origin stories of superheroes.
Yeah, I mean, they themselves are just overpowered and kind of... You know, got magical abilities, so they don't... What's to train for?
Well, this. They suck.
I know.
It takes four of them, like, with a lot of effort. It's not easy.
The problem of this movie is this last fight, and, like, the circumstances leading up to it are so stupid, and the payoff is very weak, too. They basically... Johnny Storm, he supernovas... he creates a column of fire around Dr. Doom and almost melts him.
Then Sue... Yeah, right. He superheats him.
Right, but Sue creates a shield to protect the Earth's atmosphere, which we were told earlier would catch on fire if Johnny Storm ever went supernova.
Right. So Sue, like, starts getting a nosebleed, kind of like in Stranger Things.
Right, I feel like, yeah. Because her telekinesis powers give nosebleeds.
So she gets a nosebleed while she's creating this enormous force field around the supernova heat.
Yeah.
And then I guess they, like, super cool him somehow.
Reed's like, chemistry 101, what happens when you super cool superheated metal?
Uh-huh.
And Ben kicks over a fire hydrant and points the water stream at Dr. Doom, which freezes him. And that's that. He's frozen in place. He's got locked-in syndrome, which is really scary.
Who knows if he's even conscious at this point.
He has to be.
But as we were watching this...
He's alive, for sure. He's not dead.
And he says, like, what happens when you super, super cool, superheated metal... Which, by the way, is exactly what Dr. Doom just did to Reed. He superheated him, then he supercooled him.
Right.
All right, so that's what they're doing. And he's like, what happens... When you were watching this, you were like, what? What's chemistry? We're going to have to watch Forged in Fire to find out.
And we didn't quite understand, like what happens to metal when you super cool something that's super... I don't know. We're dumb.
Funny.
And this movie is dumber than us. But... So, Dr. Doom,
he's
defeated. Yeah, he's a statue. He's locked in. It's kind of like the end of Million Dollar Baby when... Spoilers for that movie, the main character becomes paralyzed and she wants to die because her brain's alive, but she can't, like, even move her facial muscles.
Yeah.
So that's kind of scary for Dr. Doom there. He gets shipped off back to Latveria, his stippling toad assistant.
Container.
Yeah, like, ships him back. He still has people working for him, even though now he's technically an international murdering criminal.
Right. It's like you said when we were watching, it's like an Indiana Jones ripoff.
Right, because
shot,
like,
of the shipping containers.
Yeah,
on
there's like a million shipping containers on this boat, and he's just amongst them. Meanwhile, it's a happy ending.
They have a big party on a boat.
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah, they're all on a boat.
They're on like the Circle Line or something.
That feels like very mid-2000s as well, too.
Yeah, I don't know. They're having their victory party.
And the Fantastic Four are heroes in the city. They're partying with a bunch of cops and firemen.
Kerry Washington is on the boat as Ben's girlfriend,
and
I guess.
And also Ben's bartender is, like, the MC of the boat party.
Yeah, Ben has completely moved on from his estranged wife. Relationship with Debbie.
Reed's
it's only
like,
been like 5 days, but whatever.
Right. Reed's like, I'm still going to cure you. And Ben's like, nah, I like being the thing now somehow.
Right.
Maybe there's some benefits to being the thing. Like, does he have to go to the bathroom, you know?
Yeah, of course. He's eating and drinking.
Oh, yeah. He is eating and drinking. I don't know. There's no way he could want to stay as the thing. That's fucking nuts. I still don't buy it.
Well, he found a woman who can accept him in his
Again, this
stone
is a universe.
Form, so.
This is, like, similar to Spider-Man, where this is a universe where there's no other superheroes, presumably. There's no other supervillains outside of Dr. Doom. There's no reason for the thing to stay the thing. There's nothing, like, it's not like the world needs to be protected from anybody that's, like, super magical, you know?
Mm.
They don't establish anything that's, like, that the Fantastic Four are going to be needed to protect the Earth from aliens or something.
But they also don't say anything about the four of them, like, actively trying to fight crime or anything.
Right, yeah. I mean,
you know?
It just stopped,
like,
Victor.
Presumably Reed would go back to work on his, like, science thing of trying to find a way to cure them, and then Ben can decide if he wants to be cured or not, whatever. You
yeah.
know?
So then Johnny, like, he makes fun of the thing some more, and then he decides to, before the thing could punch him in the face, he flies up in the sky and does a big fire four over the sky of New York City, which looks kind of terrifying in a way.
Yeah.
Like, if I was a resident of New York, I'd be kind of disturbed by that.
And he uses his catchphrase, flame on.
Right. That's how he learns how to fly, by shouting out his incantation of flame on.
Right. What are Reed and Sue's catchphrases? Do they have them?
No, I don't think so.
Only Johnny and Ben do?
Yeah, I think so.
Clobberin' time?
Yeah. I mean, Reed actually might have some kind of dorky one. I forget what it is. It's something like, you know, Gee Willikers. Or
oh, it's not about stretching.
Great Ghost. I don't know. He does say something. I forget in the comics. It's like really outdated and stupid.
And then Reed proposes to Sue on the back of the boat. She turns invisible with emotion, but she says yes.
So she gets her happy ending. She finally lands her man.
Great.
This movie, it like, I don't know what to say. I was about to say this movie sucks, but... It doesn't really suck. It's It's fun enough.
It's bad. Go in with low expectations.
I put it in the category of bad fun, you know, or fun bad.
How many stars do you give this movie?
I give it 4 out of 10 for the Fantastic Four. I think that it's way better than when... You haven't seen the reboot, right?
No.
It's so much better than the reboot on every level. That's why I think there's value to this film. I think the sequel of this movie is really bad.
Even though it has a Silver Surfer? I was kind of looking forward to the Silver Surfer.
Well, the fact that they fuck up the Silver Surfer and Galactus in the sequel, it enrages me because those are some of my favorite characters. And also one of the greatest Marvel storylines of all time that they just shoehorn into the stupidest movie ever made.
Oh, it's too bad.
Yeah, so we'll see that next.
Now I'm not looking forward to that
at
all.
Maybe it'll be fun. I don't know. It might be fun bad, too.
I was
going to
give this movie probably like 5 out of 10 stars. I think your 4 out of 10 was the same as what they gave it on Rotten Tomatoes or something.
Yeah, it's not a 1. I thought this movie in my memory was like a 1 or a 2.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it's got some redeeming elements. I think that it had some ideas. I think that it did a good job of modernizing the story in a way that wasn't off-putting.
Yeah.
I like the whole beginning with how they get their powers. I liked a lot of the sort of world building of that these are adults, they're not teenagers.
I think they could have gone a little farther with the modernizing changes. I mean, as we've been talking about throughout, specifically with Sue, they could have just written her as a character. Like, with, you know, personality traits and interests other than getting married.
Yeah. She sucks.
That would have gone a long way.
She's, like, so terribly bad that it really sinks the
movie
more than it should.
It really ruins the whole movie. Yeah.
It really ruins the whole movie. I think that, like, the sad thing is that they haven't nailed the Fantastic Four on film. Because the fun thing about the comic of the Fantastic Four is that they were the first Marvel comic, more or less.
Mm.
And the fun of Fantastic Four is that, like, they're scientists and they're exploring a strange new frontier of science with where they meet the Mole Man and Galactus and the Inhumans and, like, all these other amazing characters. And then, like, the other stuff in the Marvel Universe starts to happen with the Avengers, with the X-Men. And the Fantastic Four in their storyline, at least in the prime with Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, it's like they're kind of in the middle of it all, too, you know? They're aware of the existence of mutants at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes a storyline in their own lives where, I mean, maybe not in the Jack Kirby era, but at a certain point they have a child, Franklin Richards, that's a mutant.
Hmm.
You know, and they have to deal with that, raising a mutant child with, like, enormous, like, powers himself.
Hmm.
And it's like, the point is, like, the Fantastic Four were the entry point of the Marvel Universe. They're, like, ground zero. And they're, like, on the cutting edge of science and exploring the universe at large, because Reed at some point invents an interstellar spaceship and then go into other dimensions. Like, a whole bunch of crazy shit happens to them.
Hmm.
And
it would have been cool,
right.
Yeah.
It would have been cool if they could have, if they had the idea for the MCU from the very beginning, if Marvel controlled all their own properties, and then they could have started like they did with the comics with the Fantastic Four, as they are the entry point for a whole new magical world opening up. Not like in this weird bastardized version we got where it's like it was like Avengers-centric and the rights were all split up and they have to introduce the characters out of order. It is going to be, like, I guess, I am curious to see how they're going to reintroduce the Fantastic Four in the future MCU now that Marvel controls the rights to it again. I don't know. I think it's, like, not going to be as satisfying as it was with the initial outlay of the original 60s comic books. But, again, I've harped on this for a long time now that this criticism is almost boring and irrelevant, you know, to the, like, it doesn't matter anymore, you know. The MCU movies and the history of Disney, it's all kind of sad and boring, and there's so many troubles in our own world now that, like, my own personal desire to see the united MCU has just been subsumed by, like, the
Your
tragedy.
Personal desire to see rightness in the real world.
Yeah, rightness in the real world, plus, like, any kind of culture that doesn't suck. And Marvel movies in general are part of, like, a shittier, like, downtrend of American culture.
Mm.
It's, like, hard to, you can't just, the, I mean, for a long time you could excuse the blandness and the sort of whateverness of them because you were getting the wish fulfillment of seeing the Marvel characters come to life. And you could just forgive, like, the predictableness of all these storylines. But now it's just, like, in retrospect, they're not holding up as well as cultural artifacts as you'd like them to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a bummer. I mean, I hope they do better in the future. I hope that, you know, the X-Men and Fantastic Four movies are exciting. But I just have a feeling it's going to be more the same stuff we got from the Avengers, just with, you know, different characters. And there's not going to be much to them. They're not going to delve into much meaning, you know. But, you know, we stand to be corrected, and we're still likely to keep consuming this product. So, it is what it is. That's my final sort of summation of this movie and, like, what we have going forward. So, do you have any, like, final words about the movie itself and, like, your reaction to it and feelings?
No, I feel like we said everything. I mean, it's always fun to watch a new movie that I haven't seen before, I think, even though, like, you know, I don't have the nostalgia for it or whatever.
Well, let me ask you this. Did it do anything for you to liking or appreciating the Fantastic Four more than you had in the past?
Oh, I guess, like, anytime when you get a little more familiarity with characters, usually you end up liking them a little bit more. That's right. Just the nature of, like, people.
The Stockholm Syndrome.
No, not necessarily, but,
I mean, you were looking forward to that sequel. I'm sorry I painted a bad picture.
I was looking forward to it because I love the Silver Surfer. He's, like, probably my favorite Marvel character.
Right.
Even though it's not going to be good, I'm still kind of looking forward to that.
Okay, so it'll still be interesting. So we'll do the Silver Surfer movie next week. With that said, Sona, do you have any final words before we go yet again?
That's it. Good night.
Okay, good night, everybody.